you say, oh, I'm just making the first movie again. They're like, no, I need to embrace what is inherent to this film and not try to chase what we did in the first film. I had to make the second movie feel very unique tonally and also very resonant emotionally, and then balance it all with the world building, the action, and of course the music.
The Wicked Witch can't elude us forever. Not with Prince Fiero and his squadron hot on her trail.
Hopefully, if we're honest with what this thing is, that this will resonate for the audience emotionally.
Elphaba, they're coming for you.
I'm sifting through 250 hours of footage between the two movies. Nobody else is going to do that. I have to make sure that I can't leave any stone left unturned. I have to make sure that my choices are built on how I respond to things emotionally. If I'm getting goosebumps or I'm crying in the edit room, then I'm going to lean towards that performance.
Will you think of what we could do?
We get to go 1,000 feet above Oz and look down at it, or we can be really close up on someone's face where the stage show can't. I had all the crane shots in the world to cut to for good. I could make that as big and vast of a number as No Good Deed if I wanted to, but I knew at the end of the day it was about these two people. You know, you have to take all the tools in your toolbox and say, this is where I want the world building, this is where I want it to be grand and big and giant, and this is where I want it to be really intimate. I cherish that I am the first audience member, and to some degree the last audience member, before we, you know, bring it out into the world.
Well, hey, everyone. Excited to be back with another episode of the Post-Production Club podcast. Before diving into the episode, I want to tell you a little quick story about this episode. So this time last year, we got to speak with Myron Kirstein, who's the editor of Wicked. And then him and his team reached out to see if we wanted to chat again for Wicked for Good, the part two of the film that was coming out. And I was like, well, do you want me to see the movie first before we chat? And they were like, for sure. There's a screening happening in L.A. in a couple of days. Can you come out to see it? And for those of you guys that know, I'm in Chicago and was like, oh yeah, cool. Yeah, totally. I'll be there. And so hopped on a plane and arrived at LA and was like, you know what? While I'm out there, it would be awesome to get to meet and interview Myron in person because we've just been doing these hangout chats virtually. I'm going to the film. A good friend that I have, his name's Corey Weens. He's an awesome director and editor out in LA. He was like, hey, if you need a wingman to go to that screening, let me know. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I don't want to go to this movie alone. And so he joined me at the last second. We're sitting in the theater and he's like, my wife is so pissed at me right now because she is such a big Wicked fan. Whereas Corey and I, we can appreciate it, but you know, there's some super fans out there. And so that was pretty funny. Us two dudes just hanging out, watching this while our wives and friends were dying to see it. And after the film, I check in with Myron's team. I was like, hey, so is this podcast interview, you know, happening or not in person? And she's like, let me check my email. And she checks and right there, he had to reschedule. So that was a super big bummer because a lot of the reason was to go out there and get to talk with him and hang out in person and provide you guys a cool episode where it's a little bit different than just the virtual setting of things. But alas, it did not happen. Still got to see the movie. I got to hang out with a friend in the film production world who just, you know, started working as a producer at Amazon Studios. So got to check that out and just really get the whole LA vibes, you know, some of the best food and drink that you can find. So it was a great time, a great trip. The film's awesome. It's really fun, a good follow-up. And then I heard from Myron a couple of days later and he was like, hey, let's do this. And so we still got to hang and chat about the film virtually about a week later. So been sitting on this episode for a little bit because it does contain lots of spoilers about the film. And so wanted to time this with the release. So if you haven't seen the film, I would highly recommend you go see that first. Then you listen to this episode. We talk about a lot of the like behind the scenes parts of the film that were cut. Talks about what it's like working on this film for over 3 years. Now he's feeling about what's next for him and the Wicked franchise. We do start off the call celebrating the Dodgers as that was the day after they had won the World Series. And I wore my Dodgers hat just for him. So you'll hear some of that banter back and forth. Excited to share the much anticipated part two episode where we dive into the editorial process of Wicked for Good. Let's dive in. I'm wearing this for you.
Oh, can I tell you how my entire algorithm is filled with the Dodgers right now? And I'm loving it. In fact,
I bet
I only have a few Dodger things. I have a hat, but I bought the World Series commemorative T-shirt because I love them. I love that nice. Game so much.
That's awesome. Not the point of this podcast, but give me like the 10 second. Like, how did you feel? What was your reaction? How are you feeling about it?
I feel like it reminds me why I love sports and specifically baseball so much, because it's just storytelling. You know, you're following the highs and lows of whoever's team you're rooting for, and when it's a really great story like that, it just reminds you why you love storytelling and why I love movies so much, because it's a great way to get lost and escape and celebrate humanity. And so that game, that series just did, it just ticked off every box for me as far as like why I love the sport and why I love storytelling.
Man, leave it to the editor to love the love of story.
Man, and also, like, just to geek out for a second, you know, just the direction and the camera work and the announcers and how they mix those things, it gives me goosebumps just thinking just the level of detail that goes into making live broadcasts, but also that level, you know, work, you know.
Well, it's good to see you again, my friend. It's been a year.
Yeah, it's I can't believe it's only been a year, because yeah. it feels like it's just been warp speed for me. I haven't really had a break since the last time we spoke. I've been going pretty hard on the second movie, and it was a race to the finish. It was really we were still working on this, still tweaking at the beginning of last month, and so we don't want to leave any stone left unturned. And everything from the mix to the VFX to the color correction and to the edit, even us tweaking edits even on the mix stage, was something that we were really trying to get right.
So take me back to a year ago. You had just released the first part of Wicked into the world, and it just absolutely dominated and really became this cultural moment. And it was cool to get to talk with you about a lot of the behind the scenes stuff. You know, we're talking about just the level of set production, like live action stuff happening, not in CG, like this, the level of the sets that were built, the realism of the performances on set with them singing, and just all of the magic that was captured. And then putting pedal to metal on the second part. And I kind of want to hear, like, if you could take yourself back to thinking where you were like a year ago in post on this, what was your process like as you were, you know, trying to balance the, you know, celebrating the success of the first one while also making progress on the second one?
Yeah, I was incredibly exhausted finishing the first movie, because that was also a race to the finish. And then, of course, you know, you're trying to enjoy the success of the first movie. And, you know, award season was obviously an amazing run. But also, you know, I was affected by the fires in Altadena. So I was trying to focus on my community and my family, and then trying to juggle, you know, I was literally during Oscar season, like staying in some random person's house, watching the announcements, you know, on like on a couch on Zoom. And it was just like, wow. It was just very surreal and weird and discombobulating. And then at the same time, trying to focus on a second movie, which was going to be incredibly different from the first movie. And so I'll be honest with you, I was terrified that I was not going to be able to pull it off. I didn't know if we had enough time to do two films back to back. That was really asking a lot out of the team. You know, the resources were really stretched between the VFX and just our own sort of capacity to like take on a second movie right after finishing the first one. But, you know, Mark Platt was like, get back to work. Like, you have another movie to make. And so you're pulling up, you know, your bootstraps and getting back into it. And also knowing that it's a very unique and incredible position to be able to work on something for 3 years, two movies. But as I said, you know, it was so different also the second movie tonally that I couldn't chase what the successes and the things that worked about the first movie. I had to make the second movie feel very unique tonally and also very resonant emotionally. And that was to craft a very intimate performance comparatively. It was almost like the Oz Dust Ballroom was in, you know, 2/3 of the second movie. You know, it's just like these more intimate, dramatic scenes, everything from, of course, For Good, or scenes between Elphaba and Glinda, you know, when they reconnect for the first time. All this, I just kept trying to weigh the second movie into more melodrama and more intimacy, and then balance it out with, of course, the musical numbers, the world building, the action work, you know, and of course the music. All this to say, I was very worried for a long time that we had to find it in the edit, where we were doing a lot of restructuring and a lot of rewriting in the edit, and also trying to gear the movie towards our strengths. For example, we really felt that Glinda, her storyline, her origin story — the first movie was the origin story of the Wicked Witch of the West. The second film was really geared towards Glinda the Good. And so to lean into that and to build off of that, you know, it took a lot of time, you know, finding that we needed to pick up this additional scene with Glinda, her younger self, at a birthday party, and to establish that storyline took time to figure out. You know, all this was happening at a rapid pace as we were trying to cut this movie together and meet the demands of VFX and then try to find the shape of this thing. It wasn't obvious from the get-go.
Wow, that's fascinating. You can tell how different this movie is and how much you guys were trying to just not do the same thing again. How many versions do you think that you created, you know, when from first, you know, assembly to final cut?
50, easily. I mean, just keep in mind that, you know, we had an assembly of this movie back when we had the assembly of part one, you know, over, you know, 2 years ago. And so, you know, we put that to sleep, but we came back to it raring to go. But, you know, it was very much in a pretty rough stage. You know, in fact, we screened the movie for the studio, you know, two years ago in the roughest shape it could possible. But, you know, that that version is, you know, it really is the outline. You know,
yeah.
As much as I love my work on my assemblies, and also I want to shout out to my friend Tatiana Riegel, who came on to help me finish the second movie assembly, because I was like, how do I cut two movies at once? But you know, it is just an outline, and so much of what is done specifically in movies of this scale over the course of the next year is monumental, and especially in this film, I did have to find my way, and I did have to embrace how different it was. Even when I was seeing the dailies for the first time, you know, I would see Popular one day and then For Good the next day, and it was just like, This is hurting my brain. Mm-hmm. You know, how different this is. And so when you put a movie to bed and you come back to it a year later, you say, oh, I'm just making the first movie again. They're like, no, I need to embrace what is inherent to this film and not try to chase what we did in the first film. And hopefully, if we're honest with what this thing is, that this will resonate for the audience emotionally. If we try to make it too much like the first movie, I don't think we're going to find that the journey feels complete. There was even jokes in the second movie that we ended up cutting out because we felt like, no, this isn't a place where we're going to laugh, you know, mm-hmm. like, so we're, you know, we're always trying to calibrate to the scenes the way we think we need to, you know, even a scene like the cat fight, which is arguably maybe the funniest scene in the movie. You know, there was a moment where we had to calibrate the beginning of that scene to allow for at least to mourn the death of Nessa, and because the house has just fallen on her. So we had to make sure that we created some real estate, these little pops of the house, you know, sort of quiet, you know, in the wind were things I had to find just with, you know, second unit, for example. I had to create some space to allow us to just for a moment to just even like mourn, you know, the death of a major character before we can get into the cat fight, which, and by the way, then we go to a cat fight, then we go to melodrama, and then that's to lead us to something like No Good Deed, which is, you know, arguably the biggest musical number of both movies, you know, and make this all feel organic and not feel like a whiplash. But, you know, there was things about the first movie that could teach us about why we love these characters. But as far as like the type of scenes and the type of musical numbers and the type of storytelling we're doing in the first movie, I just couldn't apply it to the second.
What are you hoping people walk away with from this movie as opposed to the first movie?
That we've told a beautiful love story. For me, like, these are the type of movies I loved when growing up. You know, it reminds me of the classics like Wizard of Oz or From Here to Eternity or The Way We Were. You know, and then of course, epic films like Return of the Jedi or Lord of the Rings or, you know, even the Harry Potter films. Like, I think that there's John and I really was trying to make something that felt classic and timeless. And I think these two films complete each other. And I think that ultimately, I hope people walk away thinking that we did right by the adaptation and that we offered something that is something complete to the Wicked fans. Ultimately, you know, I'm an entertainer. I'm an artist. I'm a storyteller. I just, you know, of course, I want everyone to love it. But ultimately, I just think that, you know, we're trying to make something that is, you know, is classic and cinematic and hopefully worthy of you know, a watch from any audience.
I've never seen the musical. I've never read the books. I hadn't listened to the music. So your adaptation is my first experience of the Wicked universe, the art, the story that is Wicked. How do you feel this movie in particular took all of that context of what had come before into this adaptation? Break that down for me a little bit. And if you want to say even two and how it relates to the first movie, that's fine. But I'd love to hear even more specifically, like what you guys were allowing to influence, what you were wanting to change, how much you were wanting to bring in from previous works of how this has been adapted.
Yeah, look, we had to make sure that the audience could be an audience who has never seen the stage play, who has never seen The Wizard of Oz, who's never read the Frank L. Baum books. You know, we had to make sure that people who didn't love musicals might actually like this this film, that people who love fantasy but they don't love musicals will like it. You know, we're just like trying to like keep all those audience members in mind. At the end of the day, you know, we're going to make something that feels right to us. And we feel like we're getting lost in the scene and we don't understand, you know, emotionally how something connects to another scene. It doesn't matter if it existed in the world of the stage play or the books or Wizard of Oz. It had to be right to us. We do a lot of heavy lifting in the opening of the film with the world building and reestablishing your characters. And we got to make sure that people are not lost in that. And there was a lot more of it where people are like, okay, can we get on with this, you know, and or I don't understand what's going on. And so we, you know, every day more Wicked has, you know, was we spent a lot of time taking away scenes. We added some beats with Glinda in there to give us a little bit more of delight in there. And we had to make sure that when we're dumped back into this thing, that people are ready to sort of go on this journey again. When we started to introduce elements of The Wizard of Oz, we had to make sure that people weren't lost in the idea of like, who is the Tin Man? I don't know who the Tin Man is. And, you know, and make it feel earned at the right moment. And that's not confusing. Or when Glinda makes her choice to give Morrible and the wizard the idea to conjure a cyclone to bring the house that brings Dorothy. And that starts the sort of the Wizard of Oz timeline. You know, you have to make sure that the audience isn't lost. So I think that there was a moment where we had to that we had no good deed and finish, and we go straight to March of the Witch Hunters. And we are trying to understand where we should place Girl in the Bubble. And so, you know, structurally, we're playing around where was the right place to place that. But then to have this abduction moment with Dorothy, you know, that was a new added thing that we added later in post because we felt like we needed to honor the timeline again. And so all this to say that we were all over the place trying to, you know, balance the timeline and what was in the stage play, what was in the books, what was in the movie, and then forget it all, which is, you know, I have a tendency of even with Crazy Rich Asians, you know, I didn't read the book right away because I wanted to make sure that I was honoring the movie. Or In the Heights, you know, I didn't like go back and watch the Broadway show. I wanted to make sure that we honored our films before we were chasing some version of what the fans wanted. With Wicked, you know, it's a very intense and passionate fan base. But at the same time, you know, we're not, you know, we get to, you know, go 1,000 feet above Oz and look down at it, or we can be really close up on someone's face where the stage show can't do it. We can be really intimate where the stage show can't, you know. I think a number like For Good is really powerful because I can hold on the close-ups. I had all the crane shots in the world to cut to for Good. I can make that as big and vast of a number as No Good Deed if I wanted to, but I knew at the end of the day it was about these two people who were going to be crying, looking in each other's eyes, and being more intimate. And so all this to say that, you know, you have to take all the tools in your toolbox and say, this is where I want the world building. This is where I want it to be grand and big and giant. And this is where I want it to be really intimate and resonant for the audience. And hopefully the audience agrees.
I walked away from seeing the movie feeling that part two, Wicked for Good, was the sadder movie. It was more melancholy, but I think more hopeful. And I would be curious if you agree with that or not.
100%. I think that it is a sadder experience, and there is a melancholy because, you know, the first film is about choices and the second film is about consequences. And sometimes the consequences of your choices isn't always good, you know, and to not lean into that, I think, would have been a detriment to the movie, you know, and to make it feel earned and the hopefulness at the end, you know, we played around a lot with the tone of the end of the movie, like how much, you know, where, you know, it's so sad, you know, what happens between the two of them that they can never see each other again, but you want to feel that it's going to be okay for the both of them, even though they can't be together. And so to calibrate that, took a lot of experimentation about like what should be in there, how should we end the movie, what image should we end the movie on, you know, should we just end on Elphaba walking away, should there be a moment of connection again at the end, you know, all these tools in our toolbox between like, can we have a sad experience that still feels magical, emotionally resonant, and earned and also hopeful at the same time. And it's just a very finite balancing act between all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about like what that experimentation looks like from a collaboration standpoint. Is that you working a lot with John? Is that you working a lot with your other assistant editors? Like, yeah, how does that look?
Of course, most of it is with John. he has a tendency of leaving me alone when I need to like scratch my head and get my hair out. And, you know, I do a lot of also tearing apart the film, you know, where I feel like shots, you know, I did a version where For Good was actually placed more towards the end of the movie and played more of like a flashback. And for me, I need that freedom to explore things. And John allows me to do that. And then he comes in there and he says, you know, what do we have here? And sometimes it could be a mess. And sometimes like there could be a kernel of something really inspirational there. Likewise, he'll say, you know, can you try this idea? And I'll try to whip that together. Even as a sketch, you know, the ending was like particularly difficult of just trying again, like how to continue the emotion of For Good all the way to the very ending. And so you're wrapping up, you know, plot lines and going back to Munchkin Land and having this beautiful scene with Glinda. And then we're like, well, maybe we need some more lines for Glinda and maybe we can like shoot this beat. We came up, you know, back and forth sort of hammering with John that I said to John that I really feel like Glinda needs to make a sacrifice. And John came up with this idea of her putting down the wand. And so that was not originally scripted. And that was informed by the fact that we felt like we just needed to, again, continue the emotion of sacrifice and that not everything is okay, but there's some hope there. So, you know, we ended up shooting that. We ended up shooting the younger Glinda scene and being able to tie that together and then carrying that all the way to the ending. That just took so much experimentation and, you know, putting cards, you know, on the wall and saying, you know, question mark scene, or, you know, should this scene exist? You know, what shot should we end on the movie on? You know, how can these, you know, there was a longer scene between Fierro and Elphaba in the reveal later in the movie that I ended up using more as voiceover and just using a piece of that, you know, to, again, to give us the information, but not to lull us to sleep as we're trying to finish this thing dramatically and emotionally.
I was going to ask if you had any like different processes or ways of going about story structure other than just being in the edit, whether that was at the beginning of your process, middle or end. It sounds like there's a little bit in there, but tell me more about that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm constantly sort of asking myself, should a scene be in the place where it should be script wise, even when I'm reading a script, you know, just trying to understand structure and why is one beat leading to the next beat as far as a plot line or, you know, character development. So that never stops from the point I read the script through dailies. Through the end of the film, I'm always questioning it and I'm always rearranging things in my head. I'm always rearranging things on the notepad. Of course, the scene card wall is like Tetris up there where, you know, my assistants make these beautiful scene cards, but they're magnetized in the back so I can flip them around really quickly. And then John, of course, is writing notes and I'm writing notes. And then, of course, in the Avid, I'm trying, you know, hundreds of ideas of these scenes, you know, either, you know, how we structure something in the body of the film or how we structure even dialogue in a scene and then watching it. You know, there's just a constant sort of rewatch of ideas and hoping that we don't get too desensitized to it. So, you know, that process of rewriting and restructuring never ends. Specifically for Good, it was just, we never gave up as far as trying an idea out, you know, even so late in the process. And I was just so determined to make everything feel very elegant and earned and dramatic and seamless, which is really difficult to do in something that's very, you know, the VFX alone is really difficult with this scale, but you can get really lost in it and overwhelmed. I mean, we have 2,000 VFX shots that I had to make sure that I wasn't tuning out on. And I worked tirelessly with my VFX editor, Ed Marsh, creating shots, you know, many of the shots in the cyclone scene, you know, was Ed and I sort of just pitching to each other like, okay, this is an iconic moment. How do we, you know, we get to pitch to John and then we get to pitch to ILM and, you know, where, what kind of shots we're thinking about or how should this be intercut with Morrible conjuring this thing up. And so you can just get really lost in all those details. And then on top of that, the musical numbers, which are just immensely difficult to cut. And also trying to cut two of the arguably best singers in the world, which is Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande, you know, but you have many choices to that you have at your fingertips. And so making sure that you honor them and their performance correctly and make that feel live and seamless and you're starting and stopping scenes like in For Good, you know, we're starting and stopping scenes, you know, it's just a lot of balls in the air.
A lot of editing is like, can be just hiding mistakes, right? And that's like the path that you're like moving forward with is like, okay, how can I do this and portray it like in the best way possible? You bring up a good point of like having such talented people to work with and performances wise, I'm sure it can be a little overwhelming to be like, okay, if I can't go wrong here, then how do I go right? You know, like what's the best version? Yeah.
Yeah. What's the choice? And it is really difficult when you have two amazing actors like Cynthia and Ari, you know, because the choices are limitless. but at the end of the day, you know, I cherish that I am the first audience member and to some degree the last audience member before we, you know, bring it out into the world. And so I got to make sure that I'm sifting through 250 hours of footage between the two movies. And so I got to make sure, like, nobody else is going to do that. I have to make sure that I can't leave anything, stone left unturned. I have to make sure that that my choices are built on how I respond to things emotionally. And hopefully, if I'm getting goosebumps or I'm crying in the edit room, even if there's one specific take that just feels the heartache is just an inch more, then I'm going to lean towards that performance. You know, Ari crushed it when she was doing Thank Goodness. And again, I had crane shots. I had every angle you could think of shooting that musical number. But again, leaning into a specific performance where we're just on her face and you don't leave that and making it really awkward for the audience, you know, that is all deliberate, you know. But I had no shortages of other great performances that Ari is doing. And so you just have to be brave with your choices and you have to learn to train that muscle inside of you that responds to this sacred place when you're watching the dailies for the first time and then lean into those moments and just build outward.
The thing I'm always surprised about is, especially in this movie, how to not get lost just in the style of it, but keep the substance very prioritized.
Yeah. I mean, God, I want to be really flashy with my editing and put a certain stylistic cutting pattern or something on top of a sequence. And I feel over the course of making films with John, specifically over the course of Crazy Rich Asians and The Heights, but even more with Wicked, is just being more restrained. I know that the first movie had, you know, what is this feeling, which had, you know, boxes and boxes and you know, had a certain style to it. But this movie just wasn't going to be that movie. And so I had to be careful not to put lipstick on something that didn't need it, you know, and embrace that For Good, for example, could be a really intimate number. That No Place Like Home is not about her dancing through the yellow brick road. It's about her. It's a rallying cry that she's trying to convince the animals to join her, you know, And, you know, that was a Disney princess, you know, musical number on steroids. And so I can't, you know, instill a style into something. I had to listen to the movie. As much as there is a temptation to do that as an editor, I really need to listen to the movie and to try to be restrained about what we do. So then we can have something like No Good Deed, which is, you know, a powerhouse performance where I can just, you know, as a set piece, really show how she's building this army and how I intercut that with these moments with Fiero being tortured, or having these moments where she's reflecting back and thinking about Dilmun and Nessa. And I can be a little bit more sort of aggressive stylistically there, but I just have to pick my moments and make sure I listen to the scenes.
Yeah, that moment of Fiero being tortured, you bring that up, it's a good point. That was especially brutal.
Yeah, and you know, there was definitely discussion about how brutal can we be in this this movie. You know, it doesn't get lost on me that, you know, young kids are going to be that have watched the first movie are going to grow up quite a bit with the second. And yeah. And trying to not scare the hell out of them, but also to like say, you know, these choices have consequences. And the choices of Glinda, you know, led to this, you know, and Fiero's choice to not go with Elphaba has consequences. And so all this to say, sometimes you have to do things to like shock the audience. I think to have pulled back too much would have been done a disservice to the number. I remember when I first saw the Broadway production, all that work with Fiero in the fields was sort of in the shadows almost, you know, and to sort of lean in a little harder and also to connect to Elphaba, like she is struggling. She's like, what do I do? Can I even do anything? Like, she doesn't know if she can save him. She has no control of what the Grimoire does. You know, she's just sort of like dealing with pain and anger. And so to get wrapped up with her over the course of that scene and then show the power of these little brutal hits, I think was the right choice.
Yeah, agreed. I think it provides some good stakes to the film and keeps, I think, like you said, an older generation, I think more gripped, you know, into the story as well. And you guys are balancing a lot with this, and the audience is wide. And
I know, it is.
It's huge. You're holding a lot there, so it's good. Okay, a couple last questions. I want to hear if there's anything on the cutting room floor that you just were like, I have to kill this darling, but I don't want to, or anything that you feel like was not included that was ultimately for the better, but just was like, yeah, we had to lose it.
I mean, there's some really beautiful moments with like Elphaba and Fiero flying to the nest, for example, that we just felt like was going to be a really beautiful moment of them traveling over Oz, where we just felt like this isn't going to help propel the story. And also it's going to take a little magic away from when they fly in the air during As Long As Your Mind. So that was, you know, there was a lot more moments where Elphaba is flying in general that I thought, you know, we could, you know, she was singing in the air that, you know, felt like really would I cut anything of Cynthia Erivo singing that I questioned at first whether we could ever lose. You know, there was singing between Glinda and Elphaba, which was a flashback scene appropriated at the beginning of the first film that was actually scripted that we cut out. And there was, you know, some beautiful scenes introducing Glinda on a train platform that I know is going to be really delightful to a certain fan base. That, and it was going to look amazing once we had the VFX done. But again and again, you know, you're like, I can't have everything. And I know that making this choice is going to make the film better. Ultimately, a lot of the movie did make it in. And also there was pieces of the first movie that we ended up cutting out that we ended up appropriating in the second movie, like the Friends montage that we cut out from the first movie, we ended up using in as flashbacks And so I was, even though we lost a little bit of that I wish we could have had from the second movie, we were able to appropriate some of the stuff from the first.
It's fascinating to hear all about like the things that are shot and never actually make it in. And I'm sure a lot of that too is related not just to it helps the story ultimately, but then it also is probably thinking about VFX in mind too, and just overall scope of what is possible.
Yeah, you have to, you have to make choices quickly sometimes as well, as far as like, you know, they'll say, is this in the film? Because it is. We're not questioning if it's going to be in the film or not. We just need to know.
Yeah.
You know, 2,000 shots is a lot of shots for any movie, especially the level of work that is being done in both these movies. And so it takes some of these shots take over a year to complete. You know, Girl in the Bubble, you know, that is a very complicated sequence, both that there's invisible edits in there as well as the CG work. And to make that feel elegant and beautiful and effervescent, you know, took over a year to pull off.
Who is the VFX supervisor?
Pablo Hellman, who worked with ILM, and then Jonathan Faulkner was our main VFX supervisor from Framestore. There was a host of other really great VFX vendors as well. But just these thousands of incredible artists working with us, you know, tirelessly.
Yeah, there's a lot. It was really good. It was really well done. I was just blown away from just rewatching the first movie too. I was like, man, I don't think you guys get enough credit with how much VFX stuff was in this. And I think that's good. It should be hidden. Like, it should be all supporting the story. But man, there's a ton in there.
Yeah. I mean, look, we have to support the beautiful production design and the costumes and the makeup. And, you know, Francis did an incredible job on the makeup of the Tin Man and the Scarecrow. And of course on, you know, Elphaba. But, you know, there's a certain amount of support system during post that is enhancing the work, some cleanup as well. But it is supposed to all blend in. You're not supposed to be thinking about that, you know, the world building. If people walk away and say, that was incredible production design and costume design and makeup, like, that's all I care, you know, like, yeah. And that, you know, and I cried at the end, like, I've done my job, you know. It's supposed to be a magic trick. You know, not unlike, just to circle back to the Dodgers, you know, you're supposed to lose yourself and you're supposed to feel things that you didn't think you're going to feel when you walked into that theater. And you're not supposed to think about, oh, man, I could see all the seams and that mix sucked and I couldn't hear any of the dialogue, or, you know, you're really, there's just so many, you know, just thousands and thousands of hours, you know, tirelessly putting these together. And for me, I take great, you know, just as, again, circle back to my collaboration with John, I take great ownership in that I'm the co-parent to this thing, and that I'm minding every single piece of this puzzle and trying to make sure that everyone feels great about the work when we walk away.
Yeah, you're doing a lot, you know, and I think that's a huge responsibility, which is why it's like so worth talking to you, so worth talking to editors, because it's such an important and vital role. And I think you knocked out of the park with this one, with both. And it's like you said, it's a huge magic trick that I think, you know, the box office has proven that it was successful, and I think will for this one. I'm kind of curious for you, stepping maybe outside of Wicked, you're probably one of the most famous out there editors that I've seen talk to, engage with. And that's not just to heap compliments on you. That's more just to say a fact of like, I see you putting yourself out there and hustling a lot, which I think is very rare for editors to like actually be sharing about their process and like a focal point of, you know, their craft. What is like, how's that been for you? And like, talk to me about that side of the job, of this like industry, and what advice would you give to other editors and like that maybe aren't thinking about that? Maybe they're thinking only specifically about the sitting on the box, the editing part of story, but this other side of it, of like also putting yourself out there into the world.
Yeah, I remember when I was trying to promote Crazy Rich Asians, which was really the first time I really had done this. I couldn't get a sentence out of my mouth. It was really hard to articulate any ideas about my craft, and I just said to myself that I really wanted to get better at doing that. And it wasn't so much from the cynical point of view of I want to get out there to win awards. It was more like I just wanted to get better at speaking about the craft. It meant a lot to me to be able to explain. And I think maybe to some extent it meant that I had to also think about my craft and also think about other people's craft and how could I get better at it. And there was another reason why I wanted to get out there a little bit more is I wanted to also make editing sexy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'm exactly the spokesperson for that, but like I really do believe how important editors and editing is to the craft of filmmaking. And I feel like to some degree we are back of the house, not front of the house, but I feel like we could talk about our craft and get people inspired and give us a little bit more sort of just to be highlight a little bit more in our industry means a lot to me because there's so many editors that inspired me that I think are the true storytellers, from Thelma to Joe Walker, you know, to Pam Martin, you know, my friend Tom Cross, who I just talked to on the phone. Like, there's just so many incredible, Tatiana Riegel, who helped, you know, she's a friend and mentor. My mentor when I was younger, Jim Lyons, all of Todd Haynes' earlier movies, you know, they deserve to be not put on this pedestal, but to just be looked at as somebody who crafted these incredible pieces of artwork. And so it means a lot to me to be able to articulate our craft and to get better about talking about it. And also by articulating, also in some ways also get not just better about speaking, but also to think about my craft, about how I can get better at it. Like, I feel like I'm just starting to understand my craft after 25 years. And I hope that I'm just going to get that much better over the next 20, but to be able to speak about it, to inspire others, to make editing feel a little bit sexy, that it's not a technical thing. This is our form of expression. You know, we take thousands of pieces together and we make an incredible collage. You know, every one of us make this incredible collage, this piece of artwork that no one has ever seen before. And I think to celebrate that and to try to articulate it means a lot to me.
Well said. Art is art because it's worth looking at, talking about, learning from the makers of. And so I definitely share in that passion of yours, which is the point of this podcast, which is to give exposure to those artists that are doing that. And just think about yourself, like, you know, 25, 30 years ago, just getting into this, like being able to have like a resource to access someone like you where you are at now and getting to hear about that. So I'd say all that just to like championing you and be like, keep going, keep doing it. I think it's worth doing. You're doing a great job at it.
Sometimes I feel like, oh my God, they're tired of my voice. I'm tired of my voice. You know, okay, I get it. You like to cut it. You like to edit, and you edited Wicked. Okay. But I do think that there's the less cynical is just like, I am very passionate about my community, and I'm very, you know, I actually don't love how award season actually pits people against each other. It's not a great look for any of us. And I just want to celebrate my peers. That's a real rough sort of part of the business, but I do think that there's a lot to be learned from, you know, dissecting our work, and I'm trying my best to get better at, you know, articulating that over the years. And you know, it's awesome when you have great movies to talk about as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. So speaking of great movies, what's next for you and the Wicked universe? Like, what are you thinking about? How are you guys feeling about what's coming down next for this?
Look, I've been working on Wicked for 3 years. I've been thinking about Wicked for 4.5 years. It's time for a break. at least through the new year. And then, you know, hopefully the next, you know, John M. Chu experience will be happening. You know, I'm not sure what that is yet, but for now, I'm just going to just try to enjoy, you know, the work that's been done, try to recalibrate my life a little bit. And yeah, hopefully I get inspired by something else that comes down the pike, and you know, that'll be, you know, amazing.
It's awesome. So you're not announcing a Wicked 3?
I am not announcing a Wicked 3. There is no doubt that there is plenty of stories to be told that I'm sure Universal Mark Platt would love to tell. I know that if that's the right story and the right music and the right time, and, you know, if lightning strikes a third time, then I'm sure we're all in.
Oh, I feel it. I think the lightning's charging up. It's getting ready. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for the time again, Myron. It's been awesome to get to hear the journey, you know, of the last 3.5 years and just see all that you've accomplished. And it's going to impact a lot of people's lives. It already has. And it's cool to get to hear it straight from the source.
Thanks, Gavin. It's nice to have some time with you to like just be loose and talk about the stuff, talk about Dodgers, talk about storytelling. I love storytelling. I see it all around me. Anyways, thank you. Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.